Chapter 13. It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 13. High and Low Life in Athens. Locking the door and resolutely turning my back on my experiences in the provinces, I swept once again into the bright, luxurious front parlor life of Athens. I moved from the Grand Britannia. I teed, I dined, I sightsaw, Oh well, there's no need to tell all. Now and then I stopped, as I did one day when I walked into a private dining room of the Grand Britannia and saw thick ropes of deep purple violets extending the entire length of a luncheon table for 25 or more guests, to consider the incongruity of it all. But not often. I was too busy trying to go everywhere and see everything. The first business was moving. Jean Miller invited me to stay with her while her husband, Ace, was in Salonika with the roommate, and to save myself a hotel bill that was daily growing more out of my reach. When I had said to the roommate back in Kentucky that I'd gladly pay my own expenses, I hadn't realized, of course, that living in Athens is far more costly than living in a penthouse on Park Avenue. And so here I was, saddled with that reckless offer, and the Grand Britannia charging $20 a day, with no food included except breakfast, and I, mind you, furnishing my own chamomile tea. But I hadn't mentioned any of this to Jean. As suspicious as this might sound, she simply invited me out of the bigness of her heart. Getting out of the GB was a serious matter. For an hour, I counted out drachmas, 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 10,000. Pitifully, I looked up the manager every so often, hoping he would say, "Forget it," but he never did. 15,000, 20,000, 25,000, 100,000. What it was all for was Greek to me. But I did give the canceled bill to Paul Porter as evidence that living in Athens is absolutely impossible without a large financial loan from Uncle Sam. Life at the Millers was nothing like life in Prospect, Kentucky. I could punch a bell in my room and look forward to seeing any of four people, none of whom I understood or understood me, a butler, two maids, and a cook, whose only language was Greek. The Millers also had a housekeeper, a tutor for their two small boys, and a chauffeur. These three knew English, but they were usually out. Frequently, the confusion was terrible. Telephone messages would be uncoded for hours. Visitors would be ushered into the bedroom while my hair was still twisted in bobby pins because I had said "emboss" when I should have said the Greek for "please tell them to have a seat and I'll be right out." One evening, I walked, hair dripping with suds, into Bill Corey, a charming young captain of the United States Army, because I thought the maid was summoning me to the telephone when she was really summoning me into the living room. Hats were cleaned instead of dresses. Stockings were darned instead of shoes being half-sole. Flowers were stuck like Christmas holly behind pictures instead of being put into vases. And the worst happened when a kind friend, who had lent me a pair of slacks to jeep in, came to retrieve them, and I refused even to see her. The maid appeared and sprouted several sentences in Greek. I shrugged my shoulders and shook my head. She went to the closet, pawed through it, and then shrugged her shoulders and shook her head. She withdrew, but returned in a few minutes with a pair of Ace's pants. I was more baffled than ever. Maybe she wanted a pair of roommate's pants, but they were all in Salonika. She next lifted up her dress and showed me her pants. "Very nice," I said, and lifted my dress and showed her mine. They were a knitted job, which I had bought for the supposedly severe climate of Greece, and nothing to show around, but I was doing my best to be cooperative. She stared at them for a moment and then doubled over with laughter. They were evidently not her type. Recovering, she threw out her hands in a gesture of hopelessness and retired. It was not until an hour or two later, when she was helping me unpack my bag and came across the slacks, that the mystery was cleared up. By this time, of course, the friend, or should I say, had been friend, had returned to her home in the suburb of Athens. Still, Jean and I deciphered enough invitations to keep us busy. One was to tea at Mrs. James Keeley's, and there, among many other Greeks, I met Mrs. Constantine Tisaldaris, the wife of then foreign minister of Greece. She is a large statured woman with prominent bosom and handsome auburn piled head. She gives me the impression that she once trod the boards, for she has the proud air of a former stage beauty, but her friends say no. Nevertheless, she sweeps across the room, smiles brilliantly, and talks volubly with exaggeration. That afternoon at tea, she was telling about her sufferings during the German occupation. "My dear, a German officer came to the door and ordered me to move immediately." "Yes, indeed, immediately, my dear. He and some other officers must have the house right away. I had no time to find a new place, no time to make plans. And so, my dear, I was out on the street, can you imagine, with my maid, my butler, my chauffeur, and my cat." An evening or two later, I sat next to Mr. Tsaldaris at an elaborate dinner given by His Excellency, as we say in the diplomatic circles, the Danish minister and Mrs. Hubert de Wickfeld. A dinner that began with moles of pressed chicken and moved on through soup, meat, vegetables, salad, and two desserts. The first, a fancy souffle, and the second, the inevitable oranges, except these were peeled and sliced and soaked in kirsch. And somewhere along this parade of food, Mr. Tsaldaris invited me to go with him and Mrs. Tsaldaris after dinner to a policeman's benefit ball in Piraeus. We were whisked there in a long, brand-new black Buick, one of the eight, I feared, which the government had purchased with some recently acquired cash, furnishing more ammunition to the circles that claim the present Greek regime is stupid and corrupt. Ahead of us streaked two motorcycle cops with their sirens wide open. "My husband is very popular," exclaimed Mrs. Tsaldaris. "The committee for the ball has sent these escorts to show us the way." At the entrance to the dance hall, where the ball was in full swing, a welcoming committee awaited us. They flung open the door of the Buick before the chauffeur could reach it, clicked their heels, shook our hands. Mrs. Tsaldaris sailed into the hall like a Labor Day float. The dancing stopped. The crowd moved back, forming an aisle down which Mrs. Tsaldaris and Mr. Tsaldaris and the welcoming committee paraded. There was clapping. Mrs. Tsaldaris smiled and bowed, first to the right and then to her left. "My husband is very popular," she called to me over her shoulder. "People like him tremendously." Later, there was folk dancing, and Mrs. Tsaldaris and Napoleon Servas, who had been the leader of the most active guerrilla group outside of Elas and was now Minister of Public Order, led a select group in an intricate figure, strutting with high steps around the circle, tossing her head, rhythmically swinging her hips. Mrs. Tsaldaris held at arm's length above her a handkerchief to which General Zervas clung while he hopped, skipped, slid, twisted, twirled, and twitched like a hooked fish on the end of a taut line. Mr. Tsaldaris was also in the dance, but his short, stout figure did not cavort as abandonedly as General Zervas, nor did his partner prance as spiritedly as did Mrs. Tsaldaris. Yet, as the dancers, perspiring and puffing, returned to the table for honored guests, Mrs. Tsaldaris exclaimed happily, "Hear the people applauding? My husband is extremely popular." Another day, I went to lunch with wealthy Mr. and Mrs. Chris Carolus. She was Helen Stefano of the Philadelphia Stefanos, and a very charming person. With our mouths stuffed with royal lobster, we mourned over a railroad engine that had been blown up on the night before by guerrillas. The railroad ran, or at least had run, until this day, between Larissa and Katarina, and the loss of the engine was very serious, for, as I understood it, only one was left now, and one was of no use, as the track was cut in half by a bombed-out bridge, and there had to be at least two engines, one to run, you see, from Larissa to the bridge, and the other from Katarina to the bridge. In that way, passengers could get off and walk around or under the shattered bridge, climb on the train on the opposite, on the other side, and continue their journey. But with one, short, dark, black-haired Mr. Carolus threw out his hands in defeat. It is hopeless. I could see, of course, that it was, but somehow, eating the most delicious lunch I'd had in years, it didn't distress me nearly so much as it should have. In fact, I was pretty callous to all the happenings of the day, except an unimportant one that befell me. I tell it only to show how cockeyed Greece and life are. As I was leaving the luncheon, I realized I had left my small fur neck piece on the upstairs drawing room, in the upstairs drawing room where we had first gathered for cocktails. "Oh, my furs," I cried like a lady who has lost sables. Immediately, the stately Greek butler, standing by the heavy handcart door to let the guests out, darted up the stairs to the drawing room. While he was gone, Mr. and Mrs. Carolus and their other guests, who were getting ready to leave, and I continued to chat. In just a few moments, the butler reappeared. In one hand, he carried my fur piece. In the other, a shiny silver tray on which rested a dirty, balled-up, shredded Kleenex. Amidst embarrassed and forced laughter, I claimed it and left. But I have wondered several times since whether he considered that small-use Kleenex valuable, or whether he was unhappy with his lot as butler and thought this a fine opportunity to bring a guest of his host down a peg or two. I still don't know the answer, but I've given up taking Kleenexes to the homes of people who have butlers. Though I can't afford it, I now take handkerchiefs. Then, on a Sunday morning, I went with Eleni to watch the changing of the F-zones, those beautiful six-foot-tall Greek soldiers who wear the operetta costumes that outdo the kilts of the Scots. Two Efsones continuously guard the tomb of the unknown soldier, which rests in front of the old Parliament building, across the street from Constitution Square. Frequently, I walked there and looked at them, but I had never seen the Sunday morning ceremony when they changed with music and marching. Eleni and I arrived early and took our stand on the driveway leading to the House of Parliament above the unknown soldier's tomb. It was a warm March day, brimming with yellow sunshine and topped with a highly polished lid of vivid blue. The borders about the square were shaded with orange trees and mattressed with pansies blooming in every color. Many grown-ups with children were standing in groups waiting for the ceremonies or strolling unconcernedly along the wide streets. The children were stringing the balloons into the air and tossing balls between their elders' feet. "Every mother and father makes the pleasure for the child," comments Eleni. A young policeman with brown eyes like apple seeds buried in the core of his face joins us. He had been a police guard at the Acropole Hotel when the roommate and other members of the commission stayed there. And the roommate had said to him one day, rather casually, "I'm sure that he must watch out for me when I reach Athens," and he had taken it very much to heart. During the first week, when I'd been almost ill with that cold I had, he had called me on the telephone at the Grand Britannia. "I show you Athens this afternoon," he said in his broken English. "Are you free at 2 o'clock? "No, I'm sorry. I have a terrible cold and I must rest this afternoon." "I not understand telephone. I come see you at 2 o'clock. "No, I have a very bad throat." "At 3, you say?" "No, I said, I have a bad throat and must rest." "At 2, you say?" "No, I say not at 2. Naturally, my throat was getting worse by the minute. "Good, I see you at 2 then." I knew I was defeated, but I could only get one more hour's rest. No, not 2, 3. 5 o'clock, you say. No, 1, 2, 3. And he came and was kind as he could be. So now when he joins us, I'm very pleased to see him. We lean against the wall to catch the first glimpse of the Ezones as they march smartly down the street, their short, many-layered white skirts swinging stiffly out above their knees like the skirts of ballet dancers. As you see, said Eleni, not practical to make the war with this skirt. I see. Besides the finely pleated skirts, they wear white blouses with big, loose sleeves, and over the blouses, short black boleros with tiny velvet capes. Their legs are covered with long white stockings that extend up beneath the skirts, and on their feet are soft shoes turned up at the toes and adorned with enormous palms. Tiny, sassy, red caps perch on the sides of their curly black heads. For 10 or 15 minutes, they maneuver about, presenting arms, clicking heels, stamping feet, and all the other mysterious things soldiers do when charging guards, and then gathering up the old guards and leaving two fresh ones in their place, they march off. Eleni and I shake heads with the police guard and depart for Constitution Square to sit at one of the many tables there and have a drink. There are already hundreds of men in the square, eating some sort of sweet and drinking, as always, glasses of cold, clear water. One man sits alone, fingering a string of amber beads, which are called in Greece conversational beads. A hawker walks among the tables with balloons and red, blue, and yellow balls. Men meet in square to discuss business, said Eleni. Here in Greece it is more romantic to speak about business in the open air. It is good, is it not, to see people here? During the occupation, nobody had the pleasure to sit here. Nobody had the thought to come here on a Sunday. The shops were all closed. Nobody could serve you a sweet or a coffee or a brandy. There was not a pound of sugar in all Greece. On one side of the square, a long line of people wait for a streetcar. All the time we see these long, long queues, Eleni explains. To make the queues, we learn from the Germans, but these are nothing, she shrugs her shoulders. You should have seen the queues during the occupation. My God, don't mention them to me. A woman passes by with a basket glowing with bunches of violets. I want to buy some for Eleni and me, but she insists on buying them herself. Don't worry about anything, she answers sternly, as long as you are with me and I am healthy. When some men at a nearby table begin arguing excitedly and loudly about politics, and I express once again my amazement at the freedom of speech that the Greeks enjoy even in the midst of revolution, Eleni says, certainly there is now liberty. There are 7 million Greeks and there are 7 million kinds of liberty. Another day I drive with Eleni and three other friends, Amelia Lee Kurezu, head of the children's work for the Near East Foundation, Miss Calliope Aravantinu, and Mrs. Alexander Melas, to a country restaurant on the water to eat squids and other good things. We sit outside, of course, on the edge of flat, shiny brown sacks that hold the sea. On the edge of flat, shiny brown rocks that hold the sea, shoving, fuming, and foaming back from the land. After lunch, Mrs. Mela shows me over a camp of working girls which the Greek government operates under her direct supervision during the summer months. The girls come here to spend their 2 weeks vacation swimming, rowing, fishing, dancing, and playing games. There's no one at the camp this spring except the wife of the caretaker, and she comes running to the side of the jeep with a gift of eggs. Mrs. Melas says, no, thank you. Eggs are very scarce and the woman needs them for her 6 children, but the woman insists we must have them. She shoves them into Mrs. Melas's lap. She says we must take all, Eleni interprets for me above the argument. She will be offensed. It is her pleasure. The children do not matter. Mrs. Melas takes the eggs out of the bowl and hands two to each of us. The woman's voice rises. She wants us to have the bowl too, explains Eleni, beaming. It is the way of the Greek peasant. He always gives what he has. Again, Eleni listens and then turns to me. Ah, the poor woman. She is heartbroken that you do not come and have a drink in her house. Unfortunately, you have not the time. Eleni is right. I have not the time. Nothing like the time to do all the things the Greeks and Americans want me to do. I must go everywhere, see everything. Mrs. Papastratus, who owns tobacco factories, has a different colored feather hat every time I see her at a cocktail party or at the Miami, one of Athens' two New Yorkish nightclubs with excellent entertainment imported from Paris, wants me to visit the day nursery she has for the children of her women workers. Mrs. Homer Davis wants me to see a manual training class at Athens Collins, and Leonard Crombie wants me to go slumming. I choose the slumming. Late one evening, four of us start out. Gene Miller, John W. Malwinkle, correspondent for David Lawrence's World Report, Leonard and I. We go to a dive called Mario's near Omonia Square. It is up narrow steps in a small room. Mostly men, unshaven, unwashed, and unpressed, crowd about the small bare tables. Leonard asks for a table in a distant corner, and as he seats us, he warns us to stay put. Try not to be conspicuous, he says, which I resent somewhat, considering myself always inconspicuous. He had already told us to leave what furs and jewels we have at home. So quietly we sit, munching pistachio nuts, which, as in all taverns in Athens, are sold in long cellophane bags, an idea I like immensely, and drinking retzina. An orchestra plays music with a queer, undulating rhythm. One man dances by himself in the middle of the room. He is one of the customers and dances simply because he likes to dance. Slowly, 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 he slides one foot at a time along the floor. He moves as swells move in an almost calm sea. The people at the tables watch him intently and clap now and then when he executes a particularly intricate step, but he doesn't pay the slightest attention to their applause. He looks neither to the right nor left. He is completely absorbed in his sinuous, languorous steps. The music stops. There's more applause, but unconcernedly he goes back to his table and joins his friends. The orchestra starts again. Another man from another table gets up and moves deliberately to the floor. No one offers to join him. Alone, he stands there, serious, intent, seeping up that undulating rhythm. A red rose dangles over one ear. Slowly he starts. Slowly he curves his body to one side. Slowly he drags one foot. I stop crunching the shells of the pistachio nuts with my fingers and crunch them like a monkey with my teeth. They are salty and deliciously bitter. The dancer slides lower and lower towards the floor. I forget Leonard's warning to stay put and stand up. In perfect time, the man's body writhes like a snake. I move a few steps forward to see better, and suddenly I am pinched on my ding-dong by a man at the nearest table. In one swift stride, I regain my chair and sit down. Leonard looks at me quizzically, but I say nothing. All the hour that we are there, one man follows another to the floor, coils and uncoils, shrinks small and swells big, slides and re-slides. There is rhythm. There is syncopation. There is grace, but there is also something more, something not at all vulgar, yet a bit sinister, a bit creepy. I'm not sorry to leave when Leonard suggests it. There is a limit to my appetite for slumming, even with pistachio nuts. End of chapter 13.